It is with deep gratitude that I look back on the words Count Kaiserlingk has just spoken. People who partake in anthroposophical endeavors in these difficult times deserve the gratitude, not only of those who have something to gain from anthroposophy, but also, as it were, the gratitude of anthroposophy itself. And so out of the spirit of our anthroposophical convictions, I wish to thank Count Kaiserlingk most heartily for the words he has just spoken. It is indeed deeply gratifying to be able to give this course of lectures on agriculture here in the home of Count and Countess Kaiserlingk. The warm cultural and social atmosphere to be found here in Kobberwitz is familiar to me from previous visits, and I am sure it will provide the best possible setting for what we hope to cover in this course. Although the Count has pointed out that being here may cause certain inconveniences for one or the other of us, he was referring to the Eurythmists, though it might also apply to other visitors, I must say that with regard to our actual reason for coming together, I cannot imagine where this course on farming could possibly be better accommodated, surrounded as we are by this exemplary farm. When we meet to work out of anthroposophy, it is important to feel that the surroundings are conducive to our efforts and that it will certainly be the case here. I am sure Frau Dr. Steiner joins me in expressing my most heartfelt thanks to Count Kaiserlingk's household for allowing us to spend these festive days, which I am sure will also be productive days, in just this place. Because we have chosen Kobberwitz as our meeting place, I am convinced that an agricultural spirit already deeply related to our anthroposophical movement will prevail during this conference. After all, it was Count Kaiserlingk who supported the agricultural efforts we undertook in Stuttgart under the auspices of Der Kommandantag. Right from the beginning, he was there at our side offering advice and help, and we could feel his spirit, trained by a long and intimate connection to farming, at work in all our efforts in this direction. So, in a way, forces were already working out of the heart of our movement to draw us quite naturally toward Kobberwitz as soon as the Count was ready to have us. I can assure you that I believe everyone is actually very glad to have traveled here to Kobberwitz to attend this course. And that is why we all express our deep gratitude to the Kaiserlingk household for being willing to host all of us and our endeavors during these days. I myself feel this gratitude most deeply, and I beg the Kaiserlingk household to accept my special thanks. I know what it means to offer hospitality to so many visitors for days on end, and especially in the way in which I know it will be done here. I am well aware of the difficulties involved in hosting a gathering like this in a house so far out in the country, so I feel I can give the appropriate nuance to these words of thanks. Regardless of the other potential difficulties Count Kaiserlingk mentioned, speaking from the point of view of his guests, of course, I'm sure each one of us will go away fully content with the gracious hospitality. Whether you will all go away equally satisfied with the lecture course itself is a different question, but in the discussions we will have during the days to come, we will do our very best to arrive at a full understanding of the material I am going to present. Please keep in mind, however, that although people have been asking for a course like this for a long time, this is the first time I am undertaking such a course out of the heart of our anthroposophical striving. Such a course is by no means simple or undemanding. For the interests of agriculture are bound up with the broadest sphere of human life. As you will see from the course itself, there's practically no field of human endeavor that does not relate to agriculture in some way. Seen from whatever perspective you choose, the agriculture touches on every single aspect of human life. Of course, during this conference, we will only be dealing with what is absolutely central to agriculture. But even so, we must expect some apparent detours, which may well turn out to be necessary, simply because all of this is rooted in anthroposophy. In particular, you will have to forgive me today if the introduction brings in things from far afield. You may not all immediately be able to see the connection between this introduction and the specifically agricultural subject we want to discuss. But everything in the lectures to follow will be based on what I have to say today, remote as it may seem. In some respects, agriculture has been hit especially hard by modern cultural and intellectual trends. These trends have assumed destructive forms, especially with regard to economics, and many people still have no inkling of just how destructive they have become. The economic enterprises of our anthroposophical movement were undertaken by economists and business people and were intended to counteract such things. That they did not succeed in realizing their original intentions on all counts was due only to the fact that at present there are too many opposing forces at work to permit any real understanding of these things. Because individuals are often helpless in the face of the powers that be, even the most elementary and essential aspects of these economic ventures that developed out of the anthroposophical movement have yet to come up for public discussion. Indeed, what was it that was essential on a practical level? In order that we may speak in concrete terms, and not in generalities, let me answer using agriculture as an example. Nowadays, there are all kinds of books and lecture courses available on economics, and they all include chapters on agronomy. There are even whole books on how agriculture should be organized according to various socioeconomic principles. All of these books and lecture courses on economics are nothing more than blatant nonsense. But blatant nonsense is promulgated everywhere nowadays. It ought to be clear to anyone that people have no right to talk about agriculture, including its social and organizational aspects, unless they have a sound basis in agriculture and really know what it means to grow grain or potatoes or beets. Without this, you cannot talk about the economic principles involved. These things have to be derived from real life and not merely from theoretical considerations. Of course, if you say this to people who have taken a few courses in agricultural economics at the university, they will think it is absurd because to them everything seems so cut and dried. But in actual fact, the only ones entitled to an opinion on agriculture are the people whose judgment derives directly from the field, the forest, and the stable. All discussion of economics that is not derived from the things themselves should simply stop until people realize that the economic discussions that float above the things are mere talk. The outlook for agriculture or anything else will remain pretty dim. The reason that all kinds of people think they are entitled to talk about agriculture, even when they don't know anything about it, is that they cannot get down to fundamentals, even in their own field of endeavor. Of course, we all describe a beet and say whether it is hard or easy to slice, what color it is, or whether it has these or those constituents. But with this, we are still very far from any understanding of the beet, and even further from any understanding of how the beet interacts with the soil and with the season when it is ready to harvest, and so on. What we must come to understand is the following. I have often used a comparison to make this point clear with regard to other areas of life. If you look at the needle of a compass, you discover that one end always points more or less towards the north, while the other end points towards the south. If you want to explain this, you don't look at the needle, but rather to the whole earth. You hypothesize that there is a magnetic north pole at one end of the earth and a magnetic south pole at the other. It would be ridiculous to try to explain the behavior of the compass needle by looking for the cause in the needle itself. The position of the needle cannot be understood unless you know the needle's relationship to the whole earth. To many people, however, what is nonsense with regard to a compass needle makes perfect sense in relation to other things. For example, taking a beet growing in the ground. It makes no sense to restrict our attention to the narrow confines of the physical beet in its growth if its growth actually depends on countless conditions present, not only on the earth, but also on the cosmos. People today explain all kinds of things and also arrange their practical affairs as if they were dealing only with self-contained entities and not with influences coming from the entire universe. Many different aspects of our life have suffered tremendously from this, and they would show even greater damage were not for the fact that in spite of all our modern science, we still have certain instincts left intact from a time when everyone's actions came out of instinct and not out of scientific knowledge. I must always think to myself how fortunate it is with people whose doctors have prescribed just how many ounces of meat or vegetables they should be eating, and some even keep a scale handy to weigh it all out, that they should also feel hunger if what they weighed out wasn't enough for them, that this instinct is still present. Before any science of these things existed, everything people did was guided by instinct, and these instincts were often quite specific and reliable. It is astonishing to read the farming rules contained in the old peasant almanacs and see the remarkable wisdom they expressed in clear and simple terms. And they also had ways of not becoming superstitious in such matters. In their almanacs, along with deeply meaningful proverbs governing sowing and reaping, we also find a sprinkling of sayings like this. When the cock crows on an old manure pile, it'll rain soon, or in a long while. Enough humor is mixed in with this instinctive wisdom to ward off superstitiousness. However, from an anthroposophical point of view, returning to old instincts is beside the point. Instead, we need to make use of a deeper spiritual insight in order to discover what these increasingly unreliable instincts are now less and less able to supply. In order to do this, we have to commit ourselves to a much broader way of looking at the life of plants and animals, and also at the life of the earth itself. We must widen our outlook to include the cosmos. It is quite right, of course, from one point of view, not to relate rainy weather to the phases of the moon in a superficial fashion. On the other hand, however, the following incident actually took place. In other settings, I have often told the story about two professors in Leipzig, one of whom was Gustav Theodor Fechner, a man of considerable spiritual insight. He was able to tell from purely external observations that certain periods of rain or lack of rain actually did have something to do with the moon and its orbit around the earth. Statistical investigations had brought him to this conclusion. However, at that time, people were already overlooking such things, and so his well-known colleague, Professor Schleiden, simply dismissed his claims as scientifically impossible. However, Both of these professors at Leipzig University also had wives. Professor Fechner, who was endowed with a certain sense of humor, suggested that they let their wives decide who was right. In those days, because the water for doing laundry had to be hauled from some distance away, it was still the practice to set out buckets and barrels to catch rainwater. And both Frau Schleiden and Frau Fechner did this. There was not enough space, however, for both of them to do this at the same time. So Professor Fechner said, "If my worthy colleague is right, and it really does not make any difference, then let Frau Schleiden put out her containers when I expect little rain according to the phases of the moon. And my wife put out her containers when I expect more rain. If this is really all nonsense, Frau Schleiden will be glad to oblige." And what do you think happened? Frau Schleiden refused to go along with it. She preferred to go by Professor Fechner's indications rather than by what her husband had to say. That's how it goes. Science can be quite correct, but real life can't always afford to act according to scientific correctness. But now, this isn't how we want to talk. We want to be serious. I only said these things in order to point out that when we look at what makes our life on Earth physically possible, in other words, at agriculture, we need to look a bit farther than we are accustomed to nowadays. I cannot guarantee that what can be said on the basis of anthroposophy at this point in time will satisfy us on all accounts, but I will do my best to tell you what agriculture is able to offer for agriculture. I will tell you what anthroposophy is able to offer for agriculture. So, by way of introduction, I would like to point to those things in our earthly existence that are most important for agriculture. Nowadays, when we talk about something, we are in the habit of talking as if its chemical and physical components were the most important things to consider. Today, however, let us not start with these chemical or physical components, but rather with something that stands behind them and yet is of special importance in the life of both plants and animals. You see, if we look carefully at how human beings live, we find that a considerable degree of emancipation from the outer world is typical. To some extent, this is also true for animals. But the closer we get to the human level, the greater is the degree of emancipation we find. In human and animal life, there are phenomena that seem at first to be quite independent of any influences coming either from outside the earth or from the earth's immediate surroundings, its atmosphere, and so on. And this not only seems to be the case, this is actually quite true with respect to many things in human life. To be sure, we know that certain meteorological conditions intensify the pains of certain illnesses. But we are already less aware of the fact that certain diseases and also other phenomena in our lives run their course in such a way that they replicate the timing of processes in outer nature, although their beginning and end do not coincide with these processes. We need only remind ourselves that the course of one most important phenomena, women's menses, replicates the course of the moon's phases, even though the beginning and end don't necessarily coincide with any particular phase. And there are many, many other more subtle phenomena in the biological makeup of both men and women that are replicas of rhythms in nature. If we studied things more closely, we would find that a lot of what goes on in society, for instance, would make much more sense if we properly understood the periodic recurrences of sunspots. But we don't notice things like that because the human events corresponding to the periodicity of sunspots have freed themselves from that connection and do not necessarily begin and end together with the sunspots. They demonstrate the same inherent periodicity, the same rhythm, but outwardly their cycles are independent. Of course, if we tell people that human life is a microcosm which imitates the macrocosm, they may very well reject this as nonsense. When we tell them that certain illnesses have a 7-day fever cycle, they may object that the fever should appear at the same time as certain external phenomena, run its course parallel to them, and then disappear when they do. This the fever does not do, but it does stick to the same inner rhythm, even if its beginning and end do not coincide with the outer phenomena. With regard to human life, this emancipation from the cosmos is almost total. It is less so for animals, and the plants are to a great extent still embedded in and dependent on what is occurring in their earthly surroundings. That is why it is impossible to understand plant life without taking into account the fact that everything on Earth is actually only a reflection of what is taking place in the cosmos. This fact is hidden with human beings because we have emancipated ourselves. We carry only the inner rhythms within us. The plants, however, are still very much a reflection of the cosmos, and that is what I would like to talk about in these introductory remarks. You see, the Earth is surrounded in the heavens first by the moon and then by the other planets of our solar system. In an old instinctive science that reckoned the sun among the planets, they were considered to have this sequence: Moon, Mercury, Venus, Sun, Mars, Jupiter, and Saturn. Now, without going into any astronomy, I want to talk about the activity of these planets and how it relates to life on Earth. The first thing we need to take into account when we take a broad view of life on Earth is the extremely important role played by the siliceous substances, by silica. Silica is found, for instance, in the prisms and pyramid forms of that beautiful mineral we call quartz. Silica contains oxygen, and if you imagine the oxygen removed, what is left is called silicon. Modern chemistry lists it among the chemical elements: oxygen, nitrogen, hydrogen, sulfur, and so on. So silicon is a chemical element that combines with oxygen. We must remember that this silicon is very widely distributed, constituting 27 to 28% of the Earth's surface. Except for oxygen, which constitutes 47 to 48%, all other substances are present in lesser amounts. There is an enormous amount of silicon present. Now, it is true that when we find silicon present in a form like quartz, it seems from a material standpoint of little importance for the soil and its associated plant growth. Quartz is not soluble in water. Water just trickles around it. Thus, at first glance, it seems to have little to do with the ordinary obvious prerequisites for life. But then, take the horsetail plant, Equisetum. You will find that it contains up to 90% silicic acid. It has the same thing that is in quartz, but in the plant, it is very finely distributed. From such things, you can begin to see what great significance silicon must have. Indeed, almost half of everything we meet on Earth consists of silica. Strangely enough, so little notice is taken of silica today that it is still virtually excluded, even from those areas where it could have an extremely beneficent effect. In anthroposophical medicine, silica is a significant ingredient in many medications, and a whole class of illnesses is treated by giving silicic acid, either internally or externally, as baths. These illnesses are characterized by disturbances that show up in the senses, although they do not actually originate in them, including also the inner senses, which convey pain from the organs. The senses are influenced in a remarkable way by silicon. And silicon plays the greatest imaginable part, not only in the body, but also in the whole household of nature, if I may use this traditional expression. Silicon is present not only where it is found, in quartz or other rocks, it is also present in extremely fine dilution in the atmosphere. It is actually everywhere. Half, that is 48% of the Earth available for our use, consists of silica. What then does this silica actually do? Let's put this question in a hypothetical form. If there were only half as much silica in our earthly environment, then all our plants would have more or less pyramidal forms. All their flowers would be stunted, and almost every plant would have a cactus-like shape. The cereal plants would look very strange. Their stems would get thicker towards the bottom, even fleshy, and the ears would be stunted. There would be no full ears of grain at all. That's on the one hand. On the other hand, there are substances like lime and related substances such as potash and sodium, which are also present everywhere in the earth, though not to the extent that silica is. If these were present in lesser amounts, we would get plants that had only very thin stems, plants with twining stems for the most part, a bunch of vines, as it were. The flowers would open, to be sure, but they would be infertile, and they would also not produce much foodstuff. Plant life, as we know it today, can thrive only when these two forces, the forces of substances like lime and like silica, are in equilibrium and are working together properly. Now, let us continue. Everything active in silica-like substances contains forces that do not originate with the Earth, but rather with the so-called distant planets, Mars, Jupiter, and Saturn. These forces affect plant life by way of silica and similar substances. On the other hand, the forces of the planets closer to the Earth, Moon, Mercury, and Venus, have an effect on plants and also on animals by way of lime and other related substances. Silica as well as lime are active in every cultivated field. In siliceous substances, Saturn, Jupiter, and Mars are working. And in the calcareous substances, Moon, Venus, and Mercury. With that, let us now look at the plants themselves. Thank you.